Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Real Recovery, the show that makes outrageous claims that can't be backed up. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio, across the way, George Fraser.
Hey, Bill.
Hello, George. And at the board, the always competent Alex W.
Hi, hello.
Alex.
Hello.
How are you tonight, Alex?
Good, good.
Good. Lovely day here in the upper Midwest, isn't it, George?
Certainly is, Bill.
Don't talk to me that way, George.
I won't.
All right.
Hey, wasn't that fun to see Alex at Teen Challenge last week?
It was big fun. We had a chance to talk at Teen Challenge, Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge in Chapel, and we had a great time. There are a lot of people that are excited about their recovery, and they say they listen to the program.
So, oh, gosh, that was so much fun.
It was. George, we have probably our favorite guest in studio tonight. Dr.
No
Glenn
question.
Pickering is with us tonight. We're going to bring him on shortly because we don't want to waste any time whatsoever. There you go. George, let's get into our step for tonight and then bring Glenn on. How's that?
Well, step one, where we admit we're powerless over drugs and alcohol, that our lives are unmanageable. But what we talk about on here, since we are all in recovery, we're powerless over everything. Our next breath comes at the mercy of an all-sovereign God. And just in talking before we went on air with Glenn about Dr. Glenn Pickering about this, this is going to be a great show, and I want to get right to it.
Well, George, we're going to talk about forgiveness tonight, and we're going to talk about what it's like when a person is in a relationship with an addict who wounds them seriously, emotionally, and forgiveness is necessary, and it may not happen on the time schedule in which the person, you know, would like it to, and there's all kinds of problems, and how long do you hold on? When can you let go? How does that work?
Gosh, that's a great topic.
It is, because Christianity is about relationships, and God, Jesus came to heal what's in us and what's between us.
Nice.
So the forgiveness element in addiction is so critical, and it's such a big deal, that we brought in the big guns tonight to talk about forgiveness.
Well, didn't Jesus say if you don't forgive others, you're not forgiven?
Well, Ephesians 4:32 says, instead, be kind and tender-hearted toward one another, mm-hmm. forgiving each other as God has forgiven you in Christ. So we have been forgiven because of what Jesus did. So we are obligated then to forgive others.
I believe that, you know, by the same measure you judge others, you yourself will be judged. And I think that has a double meaning in that God will do it. But we also judge ourselves by the way we judge others. And so I think this is a lively program. And
I'll determine if it's lively, George.
Do I have to forgive that kind of insulting comment?
I believe so. We should probably take a moment right here. That's right.
Let me introduce our guest tonight. Dr. Glenn Pickering has written several books. The one that I especially like is a book called Playing Tag, You're Not It. And he has a website called tagfreeliving.com. And we are always delighted to have you back in the studio. Welcome back to the show. We're going to talk about forgiveness tonight. And it's going to be a big subject because it's so complicated.
Right.
So a person's in a situation, they've been hurt and wounded by a person with an addiction. They've had their feelings, their heart ripped out.
Right.
They've been deeply offended. They've been violated in a big way. Maybe there's adultery involved.
Right.
Who knows what? Because of some addiction, something has caused disaster.
Right.
How do we start rebuilding?
That's a really great question. And I think there are three places where people are most likely to get stuck. Here's the first one. People in that position are very likely to say, Glenn, why would I forgive them? And what they really mean is, why would I forgive a person who so clearly doesn't deserve it? And I get that's kind of the mindset. Like they've been so bad. And then they will kind of recite all the list of wrongs that have happened to them to prove to me that this person doesn't deserve to be forgiven. And so then the question is, like, why would I? So really, they're not stuck on how to forgive. They're stuck on whether they're willing to forgive. And so they often act towards me as if it's a question of how do I do it. But see, they haven't actually decided to do it.
Mm. So there's a critical step one, and that is being willing to do it.
Right, that sort of letting go of that stuff. And I'm thinking George has something to say about that.
But why should we be willing to do it? Is there a biblical command to do it?
Well, here's an interesting thing. Some just a little while ago, somebody basically said that sentence to me, like, why, you know, they clearly don't deserve it. And I said, well, let me ask you this. Do you think I believe that God loves me? And they said, well, I know that you think God loves you. And I said, what on earth could I possibly have done to make me think I deserved that? And the answer was, nothing, of course. You don't deserve love. Which I don't mean in a bad way. I just mean, if you deserve it, it's not love. If somebody promises me to pay me $15 an hour, and I work for them for 3 hours, and they pay me $45, that's not love, right? That's just a business transaction. They owed that to me, and then they gave me that money. So they gave me that money because they deserved it. But that's not a gift. It's not love, right? George, looks like you have something to say about that.
No, I was just thinking Bill and I are way too mentally incompetent to take the show any farther here. I mean, I'm thinking about this. We don't deserve love, do we? But no. We get it. It's a
That's a free gift. That's right. It's a gift. And it's a gift that God gives us. And people are generally clear about that. But what they don't get, it's a gift we give to each other as well.
Love that.
And so if I'm waiting, and many codependent, you know, the people who are married or in relationships with those people who are addictive, basically are saying, if they would ever get it together, I would forgive them. And I think to myself, if they get it together, they won't need forgiveness.
Well, that's kind of conditional.
Well, it's conditional, A, but that's what I mean. That's why it's not really love. It's not forgiveness. It's like I'm getting my $45 for working 3 hours for $15 an hour. That wasn't a gift. That wasn't love. That's just a business transaction.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're not careful, we tend to treat relationships in sort of that same way. Why would I pay them $45? It didn't work 3 hours. Well.
Now I want to stay on this train of thought, but is self-preservation a huge key in the forgiveness?
Thank you. That's actually the second thing. So I said, remember, there are three things. One is that they say they don't know how to, but really they haven't decided they will.
Mm-hmm.
Second, one of the reasons they're afraid to is once we sort of, once they kind of walk them through the how do you forgive and why would you do that, then we're going to hit this wall where even though they know now that it's important and they know how to do it, they still don't want to. And I know they're going to say something like, but then what if I get hurt again? What if I look stupid? What if I take them back and then people, and it doesn't work and people say, I told you so. Mm-hmm. So there's this fear of getting hurt, fear of being ridiculed, fear of having to go bad, fear of having made the wrong decision. Now, but they also don't leave the addicted person for that same reason. But what if they do get it together? What if they do get their life right? What if it really is true that they're transformed? And then it would be a mistake to leave them. And so they tend to sort of hang in that place where they don't actually have to make a decision because they're afraid of being wrong.
And then they can blame the other person for their not making a decision.
Exactly, right. Yeah. Back to that, if they would get it together, then, but if they would get it together, there wouldn't be a decision.
So maybe a person wants their pound of flesh because I've been wounded and hurt.
There's a part of that.
And if I say, okay, I forgive you, then I've sort of relinquished a little bit of the edge I have over you.
Right.
I don't know if I want to do that yet.
Right. It's about giving up that power. Remember I said it's often not because they don't know how to forgive. It's that they haven't really decided to. And because somehow it gives them a sense of power. And, you know, you guys know about the game of tag and how all of us want to not be it. Well, see, if you've done something wrong and I keep reminding you that you've done that thing wrong and I make you feel really bad about yourself and prove that you're the one that's it all the time, so you clearly always are it, guess who's not?
Me.
Right. The other person.
Right. So I'm invested in not forgiving you. I'm invested in reminding you of your mistakes because then you are permanently it.
Okay, so if you forgive someone, do you have to forget about it or does not forgetting about it require no forgiveness?
I think those are such different things. But here's what I've really come to understand. The more I forgive somebody, it's not that I forget that it happened. It just seems less and less relevant to me.
Okay.
It's more and more and more like, yeah, I remember that that happened in sort of an ancient history sort of way.
Okay, so is it always better to forgive someone?
Better than what? I want you to just think instead of
than
what?
Not forgiving them.
Right. Now, a friend of mine always says, unforgiveness is like giving poison, is like drinking the poison and waiting for the other person to die. It's like,
that's not your friend Doug that says that, is
no,
it?
No, but thank you for bringing up Doug's name. I love that.
Well, no,
thank
Doug. Doug is just such a great guy.
Thanks for listening,
a little
Doug.
Bit of a goofball, but, I mean, he's a great guy.
He is, and if you like him, you would think he was an upright guy.
Maybe Doug.
Thanks for listening, Doug.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, now,
hey,
So, where were we?
Doug's drinking poison.
Yeah,
because he's mad at
me. That's right.
Waiting for you to die.
And so, what? And so, we play that game. So we want the other person to be it because we don't want to be it. But here's the thing: we don't get the price we pay for not being it. So I'm drinking the poison. I'm walking around. I'm filled with self-righteous hatred. I'm walking around filled with judgment, which violates everything in the scriptures about talking, don't judge lest you shall be judged. My life is all tied up. I'm focused on that person who hurt me so bad all the time. I'm continually reminding myself of all the ways they hurt me. Now, you know, if you had to design for somebody something, a life that felt sort of like hell on earth, it would look a lot like that. So why would they forgive? Well, the answer is because your life is hell on earth if you don't.
Okay. And to find out if I need to forgive somebody, it might be if I think about them or the incident, it changes how I feel.
Right.
And that might be a good indicator you need to forgive.
Right. In fact, if you have to ask yourself if you need to forgive them, then I promise you, you do.
Okay.
All right, George, this is a good place to take a little breather, and we can come back. We're going to have continue this lively discussion with Dr. Glenn Pickering. Thanks for being with us tonight. If you have a question about forgiveness and what it's, if you're in a relationship and need to do that, you're welcome to give us a call tonight, 1-877-933-2484. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery. You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
Welcome back to Real Recovery. I sure hope you're having a nice Sunday. I hope you're enjoyed your weekend. I hope you had some time to relax and you're getting ready for a nice Sunday evening. Thank you for making us a part of your evening. And we're talking to Dr. Glenn Pickering tonight, and he is author of a book that I particularly like called Playing Tag, You're Not It. And George, it talks about the game of tag. It's that playground game where you just don't want to be it. And when you're not it, you stay isolated away from all other players, mm-hmm. so you don't get tagged.
Right.
Because what you don't want to be is the one who has it. And the minute you have it, you try to get rid of it and give it to somebody else so you don't have it. So it's blame shifting all over the place.
Right.
Did I capsulize that well?
Perfectly.
All right.
Put it go, Bill.
Yeah, thanks, George. But tonight we're talking about forgiveness and how difficult it is, especially when you're dealing with an addict in your life who maybe has compromised your relationship due to their addiction. And then the difficulty it is to forgive and to move on.
Right.
And when we last left off...
You're doing good. Keep going.
Well, it's because I'm standing, George.
I noticed that.
Yeah, I'm standing.
You look tired, though.
I'm exhausted.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for that on-air observation. Do I look tired, Alex?
You don't look near as old as everybody says you are.
You guys all owe me forgiveness. That's up. All right. George, you had a question for Glenn. And if you didn't, you better generate one.
Okay, Glenn, I have a question for her. We were talking about wanting to forgive because I'm not going to be happy if
right.
I don't.
Right.
And, of course, we know it's what God wants us to
right.
do.
Exactly.
How do we get started? Okay, I know I should forgive you, but, you know, I'm so mad about this, I can't think of anything else.
That's a really great question. Do you
good,
have
it was
ones?
Right off the cuff, too.
Okay, nice. I like it. Now, here's... There are a number of steps in that process, but the first one I think is this, and it comes directly out of Romans 2. When Paul says, why are you standing in judgment of your brothers and sisters when you yourself have committed the same sin? Now, and I think there are a lot of people who have tended to read that sort of judgmentally or in a legalistic sort of way, but I don't believe the Apostle Paul was trying to say that at all. He was trying to say, here's the thing. In order for us to actually forgive somebody, we can't think, oh, you're a terrible, awful monster who's done things I would never do, because we'll never be able to forgive them. But once I realize, oh, I get it. You've actually committed very similar sins to the things I've done. I get how that can happen. I understand how that could be because I've been in a similar sort of place. See, then the forgiveness thing is a whole lot simpler. Now, for example, a gal who was married to an alcoholic, for example, might come to me and say, oh, Glenn, that's not true. I've never gone out drinking and spent the rent money. And I think, oh, I get that. I get that. But if you think about it in a little broader sense, what he's guilty of is a sin of self-centeredness. He was only thinking about himself when he's out there drinking and spending the rent money. So then I'm going to say to that gal, but have there ever been times you've been self-centered? Have there been times when you look back and think, oh, crud, I wasn't aware of enough of what other people were thinking about? Oh, I got caught up in protecting or defending myself. Oh, I was kind of selfish about that thing. Are there times in your life where you did things because you were only thinking about yourself instead of somebody else? And of course, the answer is always yes, because, of course, we have all very similar struggles. So once I get, oh, I get it, your behavior might have been different than mine. So it might look a little different on the surface, but the struggles you have and the sins you commit and the effect they have on relationships are actually a lot the same as mine. I'm going to find it a whole lot easier to do that forgiveness thing. Because now I don't see you as somebody so totally different than me. I see you as someone who has very similar struggles to me, which, of course, is always true.
I can use that. That's something, Bill, we can use because we all fall short.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's just exactly. I'm okay with my shortcomings. I'm not with yours. It's kind of what you're saying. We
right.
got to own
and,
that.
And I'm pretending that your shortcomings are different than mine, but they're not.
They're a lot worse, aren't they?
No, they're exactly the same.
Okay.
Here's an interesting thing. Sin does not come in sizes. I want you to think about that for
Ooh.
A second. Sin does not come in sizes. The word sin, literally translated, means separate. So a sin is anything that separates me from you or that separates me from God. So, yes, if I'm having sex with some woman other than my wife at that moment, I might be behaving in a way that separates us. Absolutely, of course. But, you know, let's say a woman walks past and I start to have some weird sexual fantasy in my head about that woman. I'm separate from Gwen right then. Or if I'm harsh to her, I'm separate from her right then. Which is why Jesus says in Matthew 5, you know, you have heard it said, you shall not kill, but I tell you, you know, if you have an angry thought with your brother, you're in a state of sin right now, because he's trying to help us understand that concept. We like to think sin comes in sizes, but it doesn't. Anything that separates us from our brothers and sisters or from our God is sin.
That is fabulous, because what that helps me do, Bill, is I realize the greater my brokenness, the greater Jesus' grace.
Mm-hmm.
And that really helps me.
Right. I'm glad about that. Say more about that.
Oh, I was going to ask the question, sure, but
I want to hear your answer, George.
Well, it helps me because I realize how I'm broken in every area all the time.
Right.
And yet you talked about early in the show about love.
Right.
And it's not deserved, but I get it anyway. And that's
right.
the grace thing for me.
Right. And
fair?
Right. And the instant we get that it's just as true of everybody else as it is for us. Yeah, they're broken. Yes, they've made some serious mistakes with their life. But then we have to ask ourselves, and who among us has not? We might not have made exactly the same mistakes as that alcoholic person or that addictive person, but we've made very, very similar mistakes for many of the same self-centered reasons.
Yes, I love that. You know, you're standing up over there. I feel like when Glenn's on, I should be laying down on the couch over here.
That'll be $180.
Yeah, we'll get the couches for the next visit.
That was in 15 minutes.
Yeah. I know. See, I'm good. All right.
Well, that helps me because the question what we started with is, why would I want to forgive?
Right.
And you know, you talked about the poison. And that's progressive, isn't it? It kind of hardens my heart after a while.
It does. I think it's really, really true that that the longer I spent convincing myself that that other person is terrible, awful, and bad, and I can't trust them, the thicker I make that wall, which means the longer it's going to take that down.
Well, for me, I can't be mad at Bill and love Jesus at the same time. I can't do that one.
No, you can't. It says in 1 John, anybody who says he loves God but hates his brother or sister is a liar and the truth is not in him. And again, I used to hear that passage as like, oh, man, that seems harsh. But the writer of 1 John is not trying to be harsh in the least. He's just trying to make this real point. God is love. And God's love is that which connects me to my brother or sister. So if I say I love God, but I don't love my brother or sister, I just don't get what I'm talking about, because God's love is what connects me to my brother and sister.
Okay, I wasn't going to use the word, hey, we were talking about Bill, annoying would have been the term I would have come up with, but let's say, in all seriousness, let's say that I realize I'm listening tonight, I want to love Jesus, but I don't love people in my life.
Right. And then it's right back to that same question about forgiveness. Why would you open yourself up to that? And it's going to be for exactly the same reasons, because otherwise your life is too small. So if I'm all judgmental of other people, it is true that then my life is like that hell on earth, like I said, because I'm all caught up in fear and hatred and all that stuff. But even if I don't judge people, even if I just keep them at a distance, well, see, I'm now living this really, really small life. And everything that gives my life purpose, I promise you, is relational. So if I tend to keep people at a distance, even if I don't judge them, I just keep them at a distance because I'm afraid, well, see, then the effect on my life is still the same, that I don't really have a very powerful sense of purpose, because everything that gives me purpose is relational.
This is a
That's pretty good.
Yeah, this is. It just takes time to process.
Which, when you're doing a live show, can be difficult when you got a couple guys like us doing it, doesn't it?
But you got that right, George.
So how do we enlarge our life? Let's say a guy, I don't know, he plays golf every day, goes to the club, watches TV and reads, and that's kind of a small life. How would he go about enlarging that? Not just took that out of the air.
Boy, that poor pathetic guy.
He spoke with authority on that one.
Not anybody I know, Bill.
I hope that's hypothetical, George.
But he's a really cool guy.
Here's what I know. That cool guy will find that there are at least 10 times a day when somebody in his life tries to connect with him and he either ignores it, blows it off, or doesn't do anything with it.
Bingo.
I think we'd go with blows it off there. I'll work for 500. What's the next one?
Oh, trust me. You do all of them.
That guy does.
Yeah, that guy does. Whoever that guy might be.
What a loser that guy is.
George
Guy. I agree.
So what I'm thinking is this. If I want my life to be bigger, I promise God wants my life to be bigger. So he's continually bringing people into my life that will deepen my life, mature my life, and make my life bigger. So I don't have to look for those people, and I don't have to wish they would come into my life. I promise you they're already in your life.
Hmm. So we have to make the effort.
So we have to actually be open. We hardly have to do anything except quit saying no.
Do you find you work with a lot of addicts and recovery people that maybe part of that saying no is to buy time for their use like they used to do even though they're not using? Is that part of that?
Absolutely, because, it actually goes both ways. I work a lot with guys who are sexually addicted especially, and they would tell me that one of the bummers of their addiction was that the whole ritual about getting ready and thinking about it and preparing for it and all that stuff was actually the biggest drawback to their addiction. And it came to understand after a long time that that wasn't actually the drawback of their addiction. That was the entire point of their addiction. See, because if I don't have anybody in my life, so my life is empty, you know what I have to do? I have to find ways to fill it.
I need my Batman decoder ring for this one, George.
That makes sense. So you spend your, instead of a reality, you're living a fantasy in your head.
Right, exactly, to make up for all the stuff you're not actually doing. So
even if you're in a relationship with somebody and you're still conducting yourself this way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which many, many people do, I promise you. So what I think is if a person says, Glenn, I need my life to be bigger, which I totally get, I think, okay, good for you, because that's what God always wants for you. You know, Jesus said, I came that you might have life in heaven in abundance. He did not say, I came all the way down here to earth, died on the cross, so you could keep living the same small life you're living right now. That can't be the point. So you're called to live a bigger life. And God will keep bringing people into your life that will help you live that bigger life. And you have to sort of get beyond that initial knee-jerk reaction. You have to protect yourself or hide yourself because every addicted person thinks, oh, crap, if you guys actually knew me, you wouldn't like me. That whole shame piece. And there has to be a part of you that's willing to believe that that's not true. That people got to actually get close to you, find out who you are, and think you're really great, just like God already does. So you have to be willing to embrace that belief before you're going to say yes to the people who keep wanting to try and connect with you. Or, you know,
so
that guy.
There's some risk here that you've got to break the pattern that you've had of avoidance.
Right. So there's a habit that has to get broken. That part's a little easier. But then there's also the belief that's harder, because the belief says if I let people in my life, they're just going to hurt me, criticize me, judge me.
Keep me from doing what I really want to do.
Or keep me from doing what I really want to do. But here's the really weird trick. Everything you actually want to do involves those other people.
Good point.
I kind of get that. I wasn't able to play golf for 4 years, and I didn't miss the game. I missed the guys I played with, and I realized that's why I play so much, is I like being with guys.
Right, exactly. So when people say, well, Glenn, I don't want to do stuff with people. I want there to be room in my life for what I want to do. You don't get it. It's an oxymoron. Those people are what you want to do.
We are talking to Dr. Glenn Pickering tonight, and I'm not saying George and I have run out of questions, but if you'd like to be part of tonight's conversation and have a question for Glenn, you can certainly give us a call. That number is 1-877-933-2484. 1-877-933-2484. We'll certainly entertain any questions tonight you might have. We're going to take
a
short break. Save us, please.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to take a short break and listen to Real Recovery. Alex W. is on the board. George and I are in the studio. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery. You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
We better not start with that. We're back.
We're live. Let's not start with that.
Yeah. Well, we're standing, George. That's why we're so...
I'm standing.
Yeah, well, we've got such energy tonight.
We do.
Yeah. We're talking to Dr. Glenn Pickering, and we are actually open to taking calls if you have one tonight. That's, you want to give us 1-877-933-2484. But in the meantime, we're talking about forgiveness and how difficult it is when an addict has offended someone in their relationship, in their life. And then how long does it take to get the relationship forgiven, back on track, and working again? It's one of those defensive postures that people naturally feel because they don't feel safe.
Right.
Is safety a part of it?
No. Do you have any other questions? No, I'm just kidding.
That was the big one I had loaded up.
Nice, I like it. Yes, safety is a question. That's why people say, I don't want to forgive them. I don't know why I should forgive them. Look at all they've done. All the reasons we have for not forgiving. Because we're so afraid to just forgive because then we're done letting them be it. Now we're going to have a relationship where we talk about real stuff. And, you know, if I'm the codependent person who's always spent my life complaining about the person I'm married to, the thought that now we're going to have to drop that and start talking about real stuff can be a scary thought.
There's a reason we haven't done this before, right?
Right, exactly. When I first started working with sexually addicted guys, golly, must be 20-some years ago now, I'd meet with a guy and his wife at first, and we'd lay out sort of a plan for the things he needed to do different in his life that really kind of start moving ahead. And that would be great. And I'd work with him for a few months, and he would just start making all those changes. The transformation in him was really clear. And so I'd invite his wife back in for sort of a strategy meeting to think, okay, great, where should our next set of goals be? Where should we go from here? And I was expecting she'd be so happy, so pleased to see me, so proud of the work that her husband was doing, and so impressed with me. And here's what I found. Those women were, to a person, so mad at me, they could literally hardly stand to look at me in my office. Why would such a thing happen, you might ask?
I was just going to.
Mm-hmm. Because now he wasn't the problem anymore. Their entire marriage was built on he's the problem. And now he's serious. He's gotten his faith. He's working on recovery. He's making big changes in his life. Everybody can see that. Glenn's helping him be different. But there are still problems in the marriage. Okay. Well, if there are still problems in the marriage and he can no longer be the problem, what does that mean?
She has some issues, too.
She has her own stuff to work on, of course, because every relationship's 50-50. But see, the whole thing until then had been a denial that that was true. So, of course, addictive people live in denial. That part's obvious. But so do the codependent people that they're in relationships with. And part of the denial is that anything about this is about me. But see, once he starts being in recovery and they still have stuff to work on, it's like, oh, crud. And they were so mad, they could hardly stand to look at me, honest to goodness. And it took me a while, you know, after the first 18 times in a row of that happening, I realized, oh, this must not be a fluke. And 20 years later, I got, of course, it's not a fluke. It happens every time.
That's very interesting to me, Bill. Makes sense.
Yeah, in what way?
Doesn't things like this always expose your own issues?
See, it sort of does. There's a great, Jeff Van Vonderen, a pastor who used to work at the Open Door, he used to say, situations don't cause problems. Situations reveal problems. And it's like, yeah, so if there's a rock that has a crack in it and I hit it once with my hammer and it breaks open, I think, oh, look, I broke that rock open. Yeah, sure you did. Like, okay, so if there's a marriage that has...
That one went by me. I don't know about you.
But I'm just saying, so if there's a marriage and there's an addictive person and a codependent person, they got struggles. Now, so the addictive person's behavior comes to light. It's like, oh, my gosh, this has caused so many problems in our relationship. It's like, no, those problems are already there. It has revealed now that that is true.
That I get.
Mm-hmm. Now it's more obvious that that's true, but that crack was, you know, those problems are there already. And the fact that you found out that that person's behaving in these inappropriate ways did not cause the problems in your marriage. It brought them into a very sharp focus.
That's the presenting crisis that brings it into focus.
Right, and that's all that has actually happened. So sometimes people in those situations will say, Glenn, can you help us get back to the marriage the way it was? I say no, partly because I don't have the gift of rewinding time, but also because even if I could, I wouldn't. Because if I could get them back to where they were 3 years ago, all it would mean was 3 years from now, they're going to be back in my office. My goal, I always tell them, is not to help them get back to some place where they used to be. My goal is to help them create a different relationship than either one of them has ever had before, which is exciting, of course, but also, of course, scary, because that means we're going to go places we haven't been before.
Does that also mean that there has to be the realization that early expectations or dreams of fairy tale stuff need to go away?
No, in fact, it means you actually have to have fairy tale dreams. The problem I see so often with people in addictive and codependent relationships is not that they have fairy tale dreams. That marriage, I swear to you, is going exactly the way they expected it to.
Can you elaborate on that?
Thank you. Here's what I think. How many addictive people grew up in addictive households?
Most all of them.
Right. How many codependent people grew up in addictive or codependent households?
Most all of them.
They are not living in a fairy tale marriage. They're living to exactly what they expect. My job is to help them believe that there's something way higher than what they've been aiming at.
So they're coming out of their family system,
right,
which has got plenty of dysfunction.
Right.
They're stepping into a,
right,
a new relationship.
Right, and they just recreate it. When, when it says in the scriptures that the sins of the father shall be visited to the third generation, like before when I was talking to you guys, I used to hear that as being judgmental. But now I get, no, see, the scriptures aren't trying to be judgmental. They're just trying to say, here's why it's so important that you obey God, that you get your life right, that you try and do the right thing, because your sins will be committed to the third generation. So sometimes people say to me, well, Glenn, you know, I want to get better, but it sounds a little self-indulgent. And I think you don't get it. Each of us stands at a crossroads. There are generations that have gone before us who have handed down certain behaviors, and I can either keep on handing them down so they will be handed down to my kids and my kids' kids and the kids who are born after I'm dead, or at this crossroads, I can try and do it different for myself and for every one of those generations after me.
Do we learn our style of communication from our families?
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
So I bring into whatever relationship that style, and that's going to be how I...
Right, that's what your expectation.
Life.
So,
mm-hmm.
Right, so those couples aren't coming to me because they have to give up their dream about a relationship, what a relationship could be. They have to actually have one.
I get that, because I've said things that it was like channeling my dad, you know, I've
mm-hmm.
never said it before,
mm-hmm.
but he said it, and
mm-hmm.
it just
right.
comes out.
Right.
And I'm not belittling my dad. He was a great guy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty deep.
Yep. My friend Steve, he teaches parenting classes, and he said one time to a group he was teaching, when one of the parents said, oh, Glenn, what should I do? My kid's a preteen. They don't listen to anything I say. And Steve thought very prayerfully for a moment, and then he said, you shouldn't worry about the fact that kids never listen to a thing you say. You should worry about the fact that they're watching everything you do.
Ooh.
This way we learn relationships. Not because somebody lectures us, because we just watch what's happening around us. And we are going to copy what we see. So, yeah, it's not that I have to get them to let go of their fairy tale dreams. Their dream of what a relationship looks like is exactly what they have.
How do you get them to change that for a better relationship?
First, they have to believe there is one.
So you have to do a little selling here.
Selling partly, but also, yes, and sort of a visioning. Like, certain people don't have a very high vision for their own life because they don't get that there's a higher vision.
Don't they come into your office going, okay, this is doomed?
Right.
They don't come in going, I wonder if there's a higher vision for us.
No.
They come in going, we're in trouble.
Right.
This is doomed.
They're in trouble, and here's what I know. Well, let me go back to something I said on a program a long time ago. I was working once with a woman who's coming out of an abusive marriage, and of course she'd been in several abusive relationships before that. Same thing we're just talking about. You just keep repeating what you know. And she said to me, Glenn, why is it that all men are abusive? And I caught myself just before I defended my gender. And I said, here's a better question for you. Why is it that if I lined 10 guys up against the wall right here, and 9 of them wanted to treat you like a princess, and one of you wanted to treat you like dirt, you'd be magnetically attracted to that one? The question is, why do you keep picking that guy over and over and over again?
Why is that?
Because that's what she believes.
Okay.
Go ahead.
If and we're not going to get guys here for George. We've got the blondes with blue eyes, 10 of them on the wall.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Women. And I'm going to find the one with possibly the addiction and the eating disorders.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that before I talk to them. How does that happen?
You actually do know it before you talk to them. That's why you pick them.
If they're all alike, how do I know that?
You don't, because they're not all alike. And here's the thing. Let's say I'm a guy, and I grew up not feeling very good about myself, got some low self-esteem, struggled with shame. I kind of think everything is my fault. Okay. And along comes a gal that's real pretty and real smart, but tends to act as if everything's my fault. That woman's going to seem like home to me. That woman's going to seem normal to me. The woman who praises me, pays attention to me, touches me gently, tells me how great I am, that woman's going to make you so uncomfortable you'll run into the night screaming.
Well, we don't want that.
No. I've seen it. That's not pretty.
Do I still have a job?
I don't know if either of us do.
I've often have been fascinated by that, right. In that, so there's little subliminal signs and things?
It's not subliminal. You pick it up by the second date. This is how you know if you'd have a second date.
I don't get a lot of second dates, Glenn, you know?
Yeah, see, this is the problem right there. So, but, you know, you're just talking about tending to keep people at a distance. See, I just think the truth is there are men and women in your life who are nice, who are kind, who are caring, who keep reaching out to you, and you blow them off.
So this is a pattern for us from our childhood.
Yeah, and you just keep repeating it.
Okay.
Because that's what's comfortable to you. Not because you've given up your vision of what great relationship you could have, because you don't think there is such a vision. The only vision you have is the crummy one, so you don't want to be in those, so you blow them all off, because you think they're all going to look like that.
Do we have a call?
Please, somebody save George.
That was an example. My life is much worse than that, yeah. Oh, gosh, that's very insightful, Bill.
Say what's, really? Insightful about that from you, George.
What's insightful about that for me, mm-hmm. listening to it, is there's a lot of truth there.
Yeah.
And if you stop and think about, like, your parents' relationship,
right.
Mine have looked a lot like that.
Right. Right. And so then when couples come in, that's why I say I can't take you back to where you were. My job is to help you be in a relationship you've never been in before. Anybody who's doing God's work anywhere, of course, is about the work of transformation. So if couples come to me, my work is to help them find a way to transform that relationship. Not a way to get it back to where it was. Not a way to just settle. Not a way to give up. So, okay, so now I can go back. It's like, no, no, no. The job has to be for both of us to think, okay, we're going to take this as an opportunity to be radically different so the two of us can put together a radically different relationship. And I'm really clear, if they're not both there for that reason, I might just as well send them home.
Gosh, that is so right on, Bill, because we've had a lot of guys that we've worked with chemical dependency problems. And one of the first things they say in the initial interview, if they're motivated for change, is I want my old life back. And
right.
I always tell them, why would you want your old life back?
Right.
And we don't transfer that, at least I didn't, to myself and my relationship. So this is really good. Do we have a commercial or a call?
Yeah, we're going to take a short break.
Let's take a long break.
Yeah, no, we're going to take a short break, George. You're listening to Real Recovery tonight. We're talking to Dr. Glenn Pickering. Thanks for being with us tonight. We'll be back in just a sec.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery. You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
So do we, Glenn.
I did
so
too.
Do we.
This is a
great
song.
Back to Real Recovery. It's that time in the hour where Neil Young comes on with Cinnamon Girl. And George, that's always the sign that we have one more segment to go with.
Good, we might make it. This has been really a good show for me in my recovery, in that there's a lot of things to work on. We don't ever arrive, Dr. Pickering.
Oh, that's so true.
Even if we've been sober forever and we're getting old, that we can improve our life and therefore improve our witness for the Lord in
Absolutely.
How our relationships are.
Right. And if you think about relationships and witnessing, I love that. Because sometimes people say when they really get what it's going to take to transform their marriage, I help them see we're not here to get you back to where you were. Transformation is really the goal, and they buy into that goal. They start to get a glimpse of just how hard that's going to be. And I don't mean hard like difficult. I just mean like hard like I'm going to have to struggle with some of my old beliefs, struggle with letting go of some old ways of being, and try some things that are going to feel awkward at first. I get that. And then they kind of look at me a little bit like, why would I work that hard at it? And I really, really, really understand. Because they will touch so many people's lives in that transformation. They will be a witness for God in a way that's really, really something. Everybody's going to notice their relationships better. Everybody's going to say, wow, what happened? And then they get to talk about grace and transformation and the work that God's doing in their life. So, yes, it's totally about being a good witness.
It's about God.
It so is.
We glorify God by our change.
We do. That's so right.
When we have the teen challenge or people that have gone through, mm-hmm. Addictive problems, Dr. Pickering, on here, and I hear their stories, and Bill always says, we never get tired of hearing what God has done in people's lives.
Right, right. And so when people come to me and say, Glenn, I don't really believe our relationship can get any better, I think to myself, yes, under your ego power, it can't. You've been trying to do this by yourself this whole time. This really is as good as it gets. Under your own power. So unless you're willing to really let God come with you, really let God change your heart, really choose transformation, and really let God lead us into what that transformation process looks like, what you got is as good as it's going to get.
Okay.
So, yes. It is all about letting God lead us.
So I'm listening tonight. I hope somebody still is. And we listen to this and we hear, okay, there's hope. I can forgive people. I start doing this, and I don't feel like anything's changing. What do I do then?
I don't think that's possible.
Okay. So this is guaranteed.
I mean, well, let's just take the example you said, that you tend to keep people at a distance because you're afraid.
That was a hypothetical.
Yeah, hypothetical. Some other guy named George Frazier. I forget what exactly it is.
Tell me, Arnold, you know, you got lockjaw over there. Will you jump in? And it's like when I have a 2-foot putt. Nobody gives it to me, you know.
They've seen you play golf.
Well, that's it. Thanks. Okay, bad example. Yeah.
So you said, okay, so what do I have to do? And I said, well, there are people in your life. I mean, so it's like there just needs to be a willingness to be open to say, hey, instead of picking the gal who I feel so attracted to, which I promise you, if you keep picking the guy or the gal that you're magnetically attracted to, all you're going to do is keep repeating the same relationship you've had so far. That's who you're magnetically attracted to. If you actually want a relationship with a real person that actually has a chance to be meaningful and powerful and good, you need to keep saying yes to people who make you a little uncomfortable.
Awkward pause.
Yeah, like that, for example.
Yeah.
And what I'm thinking is, why would a person want to do that?
That's a good question, George. Why would a person want to?
We hope you have the answer.
I asked it first. This is tag, isn't it?
Yeah. No, it's not. It's about we're called by God to not live in our little comfort zone. All of us have our little comfort zones going on, whether we want to admit it or not. Our God is a God of transformation. So if we're really serious about following the Lord, then we have to be willing to let our lives be transformed. And so why would I do this painful thing? It's like, well, why would a third grader upon graduation be willing to go to fourth grade? Why would they?
You didn't have to bring that up.
Oh, that's
it's scary.
Right. It is scary.
Don't you think, Bill?
Right.
Yeah, I do.
Those are the reasons why we don't. We stay in a comfort zone, I promise you, totally about fear. We're just like that guy had the one talent and then buried it because he was what? Afraid.
Afraid.
Right. So we get afraid and we let that fear run our life. I totally get it. It says in 1 John about how perfect love casts out fear. But a very wise old friend of mine once said, Yaglin, but the real problem is that perfect fear also casts out love. And when we're totally caught up in fear, we're incredibly unloving, we don't really see God's hand leading us, and we just stay stuck in our little comfort zone where we know everything that's going to happen next. So your comment about, you know, why do you keep picking that wrong woman or why do you keep yourself separate so often, that just thinks, see, that's your comfort zone. You know the outcome of every one of those interactions. Now, why would you choose something different, even though it's uncomfortable? Well, partly because God calls you outside that comfort zone, and partly because you're never going to have the life you want in your comfort zone. I always think, Satan's one weapon is fear. I'm so sure of that. And everything that keeps us trapped in our comfort zone, I promise you, comes back to fear. So then the question is, why would I overcome fear? And the answer is because you literally cannot live a godly life otherwise. You can't be in recovery from anything.
So we have to go to God maybe to pray for the desire to change this.
Yes, for the desire to change and for the courage to do it when we know what we're called to do. But also for the patience, because once I really, really see that there's a change in my life that needs to happen, guess when I want it to happen?
Right now.
Right. Guess when it will actually happen?
Right now.
It will start right now, and then there will be a series of 10,000 steps over the rest of my life when I get better and better and better at practicing that.
And there's a possibility it might get worse for a while, too.
It will look worse. It won't be worse, but it will look worse.
Okay.
Not the same. So let's say you start going out with women who make you uncomfortable because you want to be with a really good person now from now on. Well, at first it will feel worse. It will feel to you like your relationships aren't going well because you don't know what to expect. You keep saying the wrong thing, blah, blah, blah. And it will look worse. But I promise you, that little kid who's been lying on the floor and starts to pull himself up on the couch and thinks now they're going to start walking, and they try and take a couple steps and they do fall down, that's not worse. It looks worse because before they're just sitting and now they fell down. But I promise you, it's not actually worse. It's a huge step towards being better.
Sounds like somebody might be missing a lot of hockey games on TV, too, Bill, so that could be painful. So in anything, what we need to do is really get into action. And for a lot of us, where that starts is praying to God, I know this is the right thing that you want me to do, but hey, I'm not there right now.
Right.
Can you help me get there?
Right. I met a great guy after Gwen and I did one of our marriage seminars.
Was it your friend Doug, was it?
No, but thank you, Doug, for listening. And I asked him, he was real excited about our seminar, he wanted to get a marriage ministry going in their church, and I asked him if he'd be willing to help to lead that. And he looked at me for a long time, and he said, I'd be willing to be willing.
Okay.
And I thought, right, really all God needs us to start with is to be willing to be willing.
Well, maybe Doug, if he has a phone, can call us. Right, Doug?
Well, I want to take the last 6-7 minutes that we have left, George, and I want to do some recap because
yes.
We wanted to start in the beginning about talking about forgiveness and how long, you know, because addicts get in a position where there's been some grievance, there's some offense, and they will kind of live for a long time looking over their shoulder.
Right.
If I lend you my car, which is no reason I would because you have a nicer car than I do, and the 5 times you use it, I've got Burger King bags in the back. So every time you now give me my car back, I look for the Burger King bags.
Right.
When do I stop doing that?
Well, it depends. If you've talked to me and said, Glenn, I really, really don't like Burger King bags in my backseat, and I say, okay, that's a really good point. I will work on that. Well, then you have a realistic expectation that I will work on that. And you can reasonably expect that once in a while I will forget. Because sometimes people think, remember I said that we can start changing in an instant, but the process will be gradual over time. That's just how it goes. So if I really take your request seriously, what you can expect is a lot of times I'll remember and a lot of times I'll really, really be focused on it, and once in a while I'll forget.
Mm-hmm.
And not take that personally like and, did it on purpose.
Right, not take it personally, not act like that. Just shows, Glenn, you don't give a whip, you don't really care what I asked you to, because if I did it 5 times in a row and now the last 10 times I did it once, that shows I am taking you seriously.
So it's just there's no reasonable time frame, is there? People have to work that out in their own way, don't they?
Yeah, that 7 times 70 thing, that'll get you.
It will, won't it, every time.
Yep.
And the longer that it's delayed, usually the more agony that is brought into the situation that maybe it doesn't need to be there.
See, it just doesn't. I talked to a codependent person one time about how am I supposed to deal with all this hurt, which I totally understood, so I'm not trying to blow off that question. But partly it goes back to what I said before about, you know, he's also been hurt by you, by the judgment, the condemnation, the criticism, the making him feel like he's a really bad person. So you have your own apologies to do. But also to say, and you do need to talk to him. The two of you need to decide you want to be in a transformed relationship. And then you need to hold yourself accountable. Both of you hold yourselves accountable for being in a transformed relationship, which means you can tell that it's getting better. And sometimes both of you will do it the old way.
Say that last line one more time, and both what?
And you're both committed to being better.
Mm-hmm.
So you're both trying to live in a transformed relationship. You both can see that the other one's really trying to do things differently, and you can expect that once in a while they'll fall back in the wrong way.
Gotcha.
Not perfect. It's a process.
It so is.
Right.
And I just think that's why, see, a person who gets to go from third grade to fourth grade, it's not that they've now mastered every academic subject in the world. That they're good enough now to go to fourth grade, right? And I just think that's how life keeps happening. We just keep trying to get better and better and better at what we're doing, and that will take time.
Press on towards the goal out of Philippians.
That's right. I love that line because it really is that calling. We're called constantly to be in that process. And I see many, many Christians who focus especially on justification, and they want to talk about, yes, Glenn, on October 17th, 1982, I was saved. And I think, okay, great, good for you. And then what? The scriptures talk a whole lot more about sanctification than they do about justification. So the scriptures are a little bit interested in you getting your faith started, of course, but they're really, really interested in the transformation that happens after that. And I just think we need to be committed to that process of letting God be more and more and more in charge of our deciding and our thinking and our doing.
And we don't arrive, do we?
No, because here's the really great thing. Even if you go to college and you're really smart at college, then you're going to find out, oh, you know what? There are postgraduate classes I can take. And even if you take postgraduate classes and you go out and get experience, and you think, wow, there's still so much to learn. And I just think that's life. That's what's great about it. Sometimes people act like that's kind of a bummer, but I think, no, you don't get it. God's reward is that you get to learn the next lesson.
Is it hard sometimes for you knowing all this and yet still being human and struggling with some of these things?
No, not for me, but I know a lot of people struggle with it. No, of course, yes. It's... In fact, all it does is make it more clear to me how true those things are that I say. That it's part of why when you ask, well, how can you forgive? And I can think, okay, well, part of how we forgive is we know that we've committed many of the same sins, slightly different form perhaps, but very similar. And the more I'm just really, really clear that that's so true of me, clients come to me and they say, Glenn, you're so understanding, you're so caring, you never judge me. And I think to myself, well, good, I'm glad you feel like that. But I also think to myself, well, of course I don't. We've all been on the same path. Slightly different versions, slightly different behaviors, slightly different external things, but the same struggle. We're all in the process of learning the same lessons.
George, what an hour. This is an hour I'm going to have to process tomorrow. So you can go to myfaithradio.com, go to the webpage, Real Recovery. You can download this, listen to it, send it to a friend, process it again. If you need to hear more, you can reach Glenn at tagfreeliving.com. We'll post that on the website as well. We're so glad you joined us tonight. We hope you learned something from Dr. Glenn Pickering, and we are so glad you joined us tonight. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time. Good night, everybody.
You've been listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.